good as guys are rehabbing. Unless there's a significant setback, you always get good reports. But I don't know.
Have you noticed
you're talking about a 27-year-old guy who... The question is whether he gets injured again to me, not whether he can rebound from this injury.
Right. But have you noticed that he's been a little bit more visible last couple of games?
Yeah, that's what happens.
I think that's a good sign. If your recovery is, if you're not feeling great about your recovery, you're not going to be on the sideline doing that. You know, I want to help everybody out and be the great teammate. I think it's a great sign. I think it means that GBG's feeling good about his rehab. Maybe reading too much into it, but
I think it just means he's reached a certain point in his rehab where he's allowed to be on the sidelines. Like that criticism of him not being on the sidelines when he was on crutches, he's literally not allowed to be on the sidelines when he's on crutches. And it's also dumb.
Even if it was allowed, that's a dangerous situation.
Why would you do that? Oh, he should be on the sidelines screaming at people. For what?
Yeah, right.
For what? The offensive coordinators, half of them aren't even on the sidelines. You see the game better from the booth.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point in him being down there. Like Jimmy Garoppolo hobbling on a crutch and yelling at Nick Mullins wide receivers makes a difference. Stuff like that is so dumb. Speaking of dumb, I think this is the place for me to whine about referees.
Yes. I've been waiting for this.
All right. You watched the NFL yesterday.
Should we have music behind this?
No.
No? Okay.
No. I think this is a good time for silence.
In other words, shut up, Herb.
No, not that at all. I'd love your opinion. And this is something that I feel about all major professional sports, but I think the NFL is, the NBA is a great example of it too. Although last night's Warriors game I thought was officiated well, although there were a lot of calls, I thought they were mostly good calls. But you watch the NFL, and around the league yesterday, referees just brutalize the game. There are games that never get a flow because of constant flags, about 50% of which are awful. There are games where one big call, almost always a pass interference call one way or the other, usually obviously on the defense, completely changes the course of a game or keeps alive a drive that otherwise would have ended or whatever. And the inconsistency as it regards holding, I mean, look, people compare it to stuff like traveling in the NBA, which admittedly is bad, but at least they're pretty consistent about not calling traveling right, and the situations where they will occasionally call it. I have no idea what makes holding worthy of a call as opposed to not. Because and it may be me, but to me it seems like it's totally arbitrary. It's not like at a certain level of hold you get a holding call. It's just guys hold every play,
mm-hmm,
almost every interaction, and sometimes it's called and sometimes it's not based on no formula I can recognize. NFL refereeing, and here's the thing. This is not me saying these guys suck, get better refs. I think these are the best refs in the world. They've got the best refs in the world, and they stink. And to me, that's a bigger problem than they're hiring the wrong refs.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is this job is not doable the way we've got them doing it. And I made a few analogies to Nice Guy Steven as I was warming up my rant before the show, that it's an outmoded form of, how's the best way to put this? It's an outmoded process. They designed refereeing in every sport, but specifically to the NFL, they designed refereeing in the 1950s for a bunch of slow men
with leather helmets.
With leather helmets playing in mud holes for the most part.
And deathly afraid of the forward pass.
Well, and just in a scenario where there's no money on the line, mm-hmm, and not to mention no one getting paid, no one's gambling on it, nothing. There's nothing. No stakes, essentially.
Do you think there's a potential fix?
Yes.
You do?
Yes. But not unlike our fine country's system of government, the fix is going to require a teardown. And I don't think the NFL or any league is up for it. But that's what needs to happen with officiating in every league. It needs to be torn down and rebuilt for the modern world.
Reprogrammed.
Yes. And specifically, programmed is a good word there. Because I think you need to automate it as much as possible and use technology as much as possible to assist. People have this horrible opposition to replay. Oh, it wastes time. Who cares? Why are we wasting time looking at videos? And they're not totally wrong. They're very stupid because obviously we should try to get things right. And the notion that we should ever embrace wrongness out of some human element thing. The human element of sports is the players.
Right. Thank you.
Well, the referees are supposed to get it right. They're officials. They are officials because there are official rules that they are supposed to enforce officially. Not, they make some mistakes because they're human. No, I understand they will make mistakes. No matter how much you do to help them, they'll make mistakes. But right now, they're in a position where it's impossible for them to consistently succeed. The game is too fast, hits too hard, the rules are too complicated.
And they're changing too frequently.
Well, I don't know if I would say that, but what I would say is the way all of these rule books have been built, but no one more than the NFL, is you started with a set of rules, and as you found issues with those rules, you just augmented and accented and adjusted. And so what you've got is just this, I've used this phrase before, Jenga tower of idiocy, where you've piled adjustments on top of adjustments, and they're all just teetering back and forth, confusing everybody. You rewrite the rule book, it'll look less complicated than it does right now. But more importantly than rewriting the rule book, get these guys off the field. How much evidence do we need to see that they can't see a thing from down there? NBA refs on the court. It's infinitely harder to see what happens between 2 6-foot-7 men sprinting full speed and colliding in the air. It's infinitely easier for a 60-year-old man to follow that action if he's sitting in a Barca lounger instead of running down court. Seriously, you watch NBA. If you're there for NBA warmups, you see 67-year-old men stretching out their quads because they got to chase Kevin Durant up and down the floor all night. It's ridiculous. On its face, it's absurd that old men, and even the young men, even if I've got a 35-year-old in great shape, he's chasing the most athletic 25-year-olds in the world up and down the floor. There's no way. And again, these guys are the best. They do an incredible job given the circumstances, but there's no way we can reasonably expect them to follow all the action while sprinting, while trying to avoid running into someone or tripping over a fan's courtside foot that's sticking out 3 inches from the out of bounds line. It's ridiculous. And in the NFL, it's even more ridiculous because these guys are hitting so hard and so fast and running so far downfield, you can't possibly hope to keep up. In my mind, it's a no-brainer. You leave one referee on the field as a combo platter, security guard, and boots on the ground.
Spot the ball.
Spot the ball. Keep an eye on the things we might not get a great angle of on the camera. Keep 2 or 3 guys down there if you want.
You know what image you just put in my head?
What's that?
Of the 60-year-old referee after the game. I see him walking through the door after his day at work. And like a June Cleaver type there with his smoking jacket and his martini.
Right.
That's
what era
these guys are from.
Some of them. And it's actually getting worse as those guys go away because they figured it out to some degree. And now we got guys. There's a lot of fresh refs in both the NBA and the NFL over the last couple of years. And it has not done favors for the quality of officiating.
It's really noticeable in the NBA how much younger the refs are getting. Like a whole wave
is
bowing out.
It is. So anyway, you got to fix this. You got to fix this, and it's going to require a major action, and I hope someone in the NFL can sort of speak truth to power here and just start a process, because the effect in particular that pass interference calls have on the game, you can coach to draw them.
Yeah, sure.
Just run deep and fight back through it, and they change the game. It's such a big call. One pass interference call can flip a game so easily, and to not be able to review it, to not have a ref who could always get a good angle on it, it's a disaster. And it's going to get worse because passing is more and more popular. There's going to be more and more defensive holding and pass interference calls having major effects on games, keeping drives going to clinch a victory or to lead to a game-winning score. It's just, it's going to be worse and worse. It's something that really, we really got to deal with it.
You know, I've heard a bunch of people say that they support the automation of umpires in baseball. That's the sport that I hear
100%.
Most. Let, you know, make it an e-sport to a certain degree, or at least e-officiated. I've never heard anybody throw out the suggestion that the NFL follow suit, but that makes all the sense in the world. NFL's got the best coverage of their playing surface in terms of cameras in the big games than any other sport. I mean, they have a million angles, including
but everybody right does. Above. Everybody does. And I keep hearing these this criticism like, well, this is only a problem because Twitter and the social media, now we see everything 50 times. Well, that's the world. We now live in a world where you see things 50 times. Mm-hmm. So you want to sit around and complain about it and talk about how, man, if the world wasn't the way it is, this would be a lot better? Or do you want to do something and fix it? That's the thing. That, to me, is the issue. Let's get back into the Niners specifically. However, we will talk to Matt Barrows in about 15 minutes. In the meantime, we'll talk to you. How are you feeling after a game against the Bears that was awfully competitive?
It's the perfect game for a Niner fan.
Michael Urban thinks it's the perfect game for the 49er fan. I agree. You should be thrilled with the result, but are you? 888-957-9570, Chilton Auto Body text line 95795. Bears, Niners, and more Niners coming up next on 95.7 The Game.
Now back to Not Joe, Low, and Dibs on 95.7 The Game.
We are Not Joe, Low, and Dibs. I'm Matt Kolsky. He's Michael Urban. We are on Joe, Low, and Dibs Twitter. If you want to tweet at us, Steven is monitoring our Twitter account, or at least I presume he is. If he's not, you come at Nice Guy Steven on Twitter. Is it at Nice Guy Steven?
It is. Thanks for the plug.
You get after him. If he's not listening to your tweets at Joe Low and Dibs, you just go right at Nice Guy Steven, just straight to the source.
Can we just keep that music going, man? It gave me a really good vibe. That was Mac Miller, right? The Late, The Mist.
Oh, man.
With Anderson .Paak.
I've listened to so much Mac Miller in memoriam stuff
over the
last month.
Heavy rotation.
Yeah.
He was really ascending creatively still, clearly evidenced by Swimming, his best album.
It's really sad. Big Ray on Twitter mentioning in that ACL discussion we were having about Jimmy Garoppolo, Deshaun Watson tore his ACL in week 9 last year, and he's pretty much played all year. Not only has he played all year, he's running great right now, and maybe more to the point, he's been getting hammered all year, and he's held up pretty well, although he did have to take a bus instead of a plane because his ribs were so screwed up one week. Hopefully the Niners protect Garoppolo better than that. But I think in terms of recovering from an ACL, we're just in a new world, man. This is not, you know, Gale Sayers lost his career over an ACL. It doesn't work that way anymore. Talking Niners and Bears after what I think and what Michael Urban just said is the best possible result the Niners could have had yesterday. Explain that a little more for us, Urbs, before we go to the phones. If you want to weigh in, 888-957-9570 is the phone number. The Chilton Auto Body text line is 95795.
Well, it's pretty simple. You get the best of both worlds. You got to watch your team compete and hold their own against the best defense in the NFL by far. It was entertaining. You had a chance to win at the very end, but you didn't win. So your draft position did not fall.
And I did the math on this after last week's win for the Niners.
Which I was fine with, by the way, just because of the opponent.
Well, I think there's a misconception that happens with the tanking talk, because the word tanking is such anathema to fans. Why would they try to lose? Every NFL team is always close to winning. Wins are all that matter, blah, blah, blah. And the fact is, I understand why people say that. It's coach speak. It wins are the most important thing in an ideal world. What you want to do, the goal is to win it all. I get that. But the idea that wins are all that matter is very stupid. Very, very stupid. That's just, it's ridiculous. Wins are simply not all that matter, ever, to anyone.
It depends. How much they matter depends on where your franchise is at.
That's exactly right.
Whether you feel good about where you're at.
And that just the beginning of it is enough. How much the value of a win depends on the status of your franchise. And I'm with you. A win over the Seahawks, given the status of the Niners franchise, had more value than just a one in the W column. You're beating your rival, right, who you haven't beaten in 10 games in 4 or 5 years, whatever it was. You're taking a playoff team down a peg and showing that your squad with a lost season still has some fight left in it. Mm-hmm. Those are valuable things. I see the value there. Taking on a Bears team yesterday, a Rams team next week, teams that are ticketed for playoffs no matter what you do to them, teams that are on a totally different level than you are, broadly speaking, in terms of overall talent and goals for this season. I don't see the value in those wins. I truly don't. When you consider that wins in these scenarios, and again, I crunch the math on this, it's not, when you're talking about the difference between 1 through 3 in the draft and 3 through 6, all right, not a huge difference. Right. When you're talking about getting into the 10 to 13 range, because right now, that's where the Niners are at. Their schedule has been so weak, and like weaker schedule wins the tiebreaker for draft position. Their schedule's been so weak that if they end up with the same number of wins as teams that are one game ahead of them right now, like the New York Jets or the, and actually they're tied with the Jets. So now they're tied with the Jets, but if they end up with the same record as teams like the Lions, the Buccaneers, the Giants, the Jaguars, and the Bills, that's 5 more teams that they would be even within wins if they win and those teams don't. And they could fall behind all of them in draft position, right, potentially. So that now you're talking about going down to 10 or 12, and then you are getting a significantly worse player or significantly worse value if you try to trade out of that pick. Mm-hmm. So you really don't want these wins. You do want to see young players be competitive. We're seeing that on defense. We're seeing that with Nick Mullins. You do want to see guys not get seriously injured, which, have we heard about Dante Pettis yet today? It looked bad when he went down. When he walked off, I didn't feel as bad about it. But I think you avoided major injury yesterday, as far as I could tell.
Poor guy, man. He was just starting to emerge.
It's brutal. But you competed against a really good football, yep, team, and most of the guys that you're planning on retaining going into next year did things to show you why, mm-hmm, you're retaining them. Before we get to Matt Barrows in a couple of minutes, let's quickly get to Alex in Brisbane. What's up, Alex? I gave it the Australian pronunciation.
Notice that. Nice.
What's going on, Alex?
Yeah, all good. Yeah, well, brilliant take on the referees, by the way.
That, oh, thanks.
Phenomenal. The Pittsburgh-New Orleans game, I mean, there's such a horrific interference in the end zone that, yep, literally turns the game around and could cost Pittsburgh their entire season. They went from winning the division, basically, to almost out of the playoffs. So, it's bad. But that was an awesome take. And the 49ers, I've been ripping them all year with the graphics. I gotta give it some credit. I mean, Solomon Thomas plays his best game, I think, in his career. McGlinchey's been solid. Obviously, Kittle's a stud. I mean, and I never went from it. I'm sitting there watching the game, and I'm like jumping through the television saying Mullen should run instead of throwing that deep pass down. But then I realized, hey, it's a better draft pick, so I sat back down. So I don't know. It was just I give them credit. The graphics looked ugly, but they're starting to come around, and I think there's only good things in the future, and CJ's got to go, but I would keep Mullins around.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Alex, and I think that gives you the picture of where a reasonable 49er fan is at right now, right?
He couldn't have been, feeling, that was like a prototype.
But that feeling does rise up in you when you watch your quarterback,
yeah,
and you're like, yeah, the first down, what are you doing? And then you're like, that's all right.
That's what makes it so great. You can be pumped with a loss.
That's what makes yesterday great. And I will just say, as far as the draft pick situation goes, you know what? Before I do my thing, let's go to Antonio in Oakland, who also wants to talk about the draft pick situation. What's up, Antonio?
Oh, hey, you guys. You know, about a month and a half ago, you know, people were saying, oh, my God, what is Shanahan and Lynch doing with all these draft picks? They look like busts. Well, as you can see, McGlinchey shut down Khalil Mack yesterday. You know, only giving up one pressure. Dante Pettis looks like a pretty good route runner. Poor man's Amari Cooper. You know, freaking Fred Warner looks like a good player. Mm-hmm. Marcel Harris looks like a good player. DJ Reed nominated for, what, Rookie of the Week or Defensive Player of the Week
yep.
weeks ago. You know what I'm saying? Solomon Thomas looks like a, you know, he's been coming on these past couple weeks, getting better and better. You know, man, I really like this talent, you know, going forward. So, you know, everybody needs to pump the brakes, stop the bus talk. You know what I'm saying? All these guys are playing pretty good right now. They're going to be even better next year. You know what I'm saying? So, oh, yeah. Also, George Kittle, who might be the best player from his draft class, needs 100 yards to break the all-time record.
And he was a fifth-rounder, Antonio. Yeah, thank you. I think this is – and both of them – we just had two calls in a row praise John Lynch's drafting. I just want to say that it's equally premature – to love Marcel Harris and DJ Reed and to say, oh, Solomon Thomas is playing better. It's just as silly as when 1 year into his tenure, people were saying, well, he'll never have a good draft pick. He can't draft. He's a terrible drafter. We don't know how good he is. We know he's gotten some great value in later rounds. We know he's failed on a couple of earlier picks.
But Matt, but the geniuses told us he won the draft first year.
Yeah, that's right. 30 seconds into his tenure, he was the greatest drafter ever. A year later, he's the worst. Now, apparently, he's better. Let's just chill. We won't actually know how good John Lynch is at drafting for another few years yet. We do know how good Matt Barrows is at covering the San Francisco 49ers because he has been doing it for the Sacramento Bee. And now for The Athletic, we welcome Matty Barrows to the show. Matt Kolsky here, Michael Urban right over there.
What up, man?
And Matt, let's just start with this because this is what we kind of been asking Niner fans today. All things considered, yesterday's about as good a result as you could ask for if you're a smart Niner fan because you compete, you show some value in some of your young players, including a young backup quarterback of the future, and you get an L so you don't screw up draft position anymore. That's all good, right?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And, you know, just the way that the game played out with that sideline fight, I mean, I feel like that galvanized this team even more heading into 2019. So you have all the benefits of a late-season game. You're getting Tarvarius Moore, good snaps. You're getting all these young guys, quality play. You're coming together as a team. Leaders are being established, and you get the handy L for heading into the draft. So a lot of boxes checked in that game.
Hey, Matt, a recent piece you wrote for The Athletic mentioned that Mullins and Marquise Goodwin aren't necessarily on the same page. Can you dive into that just a little bit deeper, expand on it for the audience?
Well, you know, the main issue was that that big turnover, which was, you know, the probably the most critical play of the game for the 49ers, their best scoring chance in the second half. And it looked as if Marquise Goodwin might have pulled up a little bit on that play, and it led to an interception. I was just noting that Goodwin hasn't played very much recently. He had a calf injury a week ago. He had a personal matter. And more than that, it's the impetus of the 49ers wanting to see a lot of Dante Pettis at the end of the season. And so that's put Marquise Goodwin on the sideline during much of Nick Mullins' starting tenure here. And it was just clear that they weren't, you know, as connected as Pettis and Mullins have been. Now, having gone back and looked over this game just now, a lot of the passes that were on their way to Goodwin were tipped at the line of scrimmage. So I may have overstated that a bit in what I wrote. It seemed like there was a reason for some of the incompletions. I think he only completed 3 of 8 passes, but at least 2 of them were tipped at the line of scrimmage.
You mentioned Dante Pettis. He has the knee injury yesterday, but I understand this is not something they think is long-term. It may be he doesn't play next week, but they expect him to be fine by next season?
Yeah, we'll get more clarification from Kyle Shanahan later today, but it didn't seem like it was a long-term injury. I mean, MCL sprains are no small thing, but certainly not like an ACL would be, and that seemed to be what it was. He was walking off the field slowly yesterday, but the further he walked, the looser it seemed to get and the faster he went. So this does seem like something that would rule him out for the finale on Sunday in Los Angeles, but not something that would linger deep into the offseason.
If that is in fact the case, Marquise Goodwin looked like he might have strained something on his way off the field. So who is going to play wide receiver next week?
I have no idea. The options are pretty slim. You've got Kendrick Bourne on one side, but the question would be who comes in and plays that X receiver spot, which is really the marquee spot, no pun intended, in the offense. You've got Richie James as a possibility. You've got Trent Taylor as a possibility, but those are two slot guys. So they're going to have to, you know, get creative and bring some guys up. They do have one guy on the practice squad that they could bring up, but they may actually have to bring in an additional player.
So, Matt, is it a given that Mullins is the backup to Jimmy G next year?
I think it's a given. I think that Kyle Shanahan's going to want to have a competition, even if it's in his heart. He knows that Mullins is better than C.J. Beathard. I think that it's partly because of the tone that he wants to strike this offseason. I think if he goes back and looks at what went wrong in 2018, you can start in the offseason, and they just did not have a lot of competition up and down the roster. They essentially handed starting jobs to 23-year-old guys who, to their credit, played well in 2017, but who needed to be pushed, I think, in 2018. He just didn't have that going into the season. And, the results, the slow start showed that. And I think having a quarterback competition, Jimmy Garoppolo is not going to be practicing, when they first start the offseason, at least. Between Beathard and Mullins, like I said, sort of gives the whole team, the whole roster, that tone that you want, and kind of creates the pressure that was missing last offseason.
Our guest is Matt Barrows, who covers the Niners for The Athletic. And given everything you just said, it's not that I wasn't listening, but I have to assume there is a Godfather offer for C.J. Beathard that would change the equation you just laid out. So I guess my question would be, what do you think Beathard's value is, and what would the offer have to be from a team desperate for a backup quarterback to convince Kyle Shanahan we're better off with X as opposed to having Mullins and Beathard competing for a backup spot?
I think it would have to be good. I mean, I think it would have to be Beathard's draft value, third-round pick.
And oh, wow, okay.
I doubt that you get anything close to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure. I don't think anybody would make an offer for Beathard at this point. I mean, okay. It could go either way with him now. Kyle Shanahan obviously believes in him and likens him to Kirk Cousins, pointing out the similarities at this point in Cousins' career. But again, I think the value of having him with Garoppolo coming off the knee injury, with that question mark sort of looming over the offseason, and like I said, with the value of having a competition, I think both of those things vastly outweigh anything any team would offer for C.J. Beathard at this point.
Is there anybody with extremely high trade value on this roster? Like, at this point, who would you say has the most?
DeForest Buckner. I don't think
they're not giving him up.
No, I mean, that's my point. I don't think there's anybody that the 49ers would be willing to give up who would foster a trade. I mean, they would be willing to give up Joshua Garnett, for example, but what are you going to give up for the guy?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know. I mean, Eric Armstead, people have asked me, well, why don't they just trade Eric Armstead? Well, he's going to make $9 million next season. So any team that trades for him would have to take on that salary. And if you think that the 49ers are going to cut Eric Armstead, then why, just wait around until that cut happens, and why give anything up for him when you can get him for free in free agency?
One more for you before we let you go, Matt. Just looking forward to next season, the more I look at this roster, the more I think the offense is actually pretty much you've got on the roster everything you're going to have, minus maybe a guard, maybe a wide receiver, but I don't know who that wide receiver would be based on the free agency class. So I look at what they'll do with the defense, and I think a lot has been made, and obviously we mostly all agree that an edge pass rusher is the number one priority. But I'm curious, after that, what do you think is next up for this Niner team? Because I think there's holes at every level of the defense. You might need an offensive guard, I suppose. Some people might still think wide receiver is that next biggest need. After they address pass rush from the outside, what do you feel like the biggest hole for this team is?
Well, going back to what I said earlier, I think Shanahan wants competition at just about every position on this team, especially where you've got young guys. So, you know, it looks like you're going to have that at strong safety, for example, with Marcel Harris and Jaquiski Tartt competing there. You've got two good nickel cornerbacks with Kaywan Williams and DJ Reed. You get to free safety, and you got Adrian Colbert coming back from IR, a bad ankle injury that required surgery. But there's a question mark. I mean, who else is competing with him there? So I think that's one area. And then on the other side, you've got Richard Sherman, you know, getting stronger and stronger as the year goes on. He's a given at left cornerback. At right cornerback, right now it looks like it's a competition between Tarvarius Moore and Akella Witherspoon. And the question is, do the 49ers want to bring in one more guy, a veteran, to kind of really push those two youngsters? And I'm not sure what the answer is, but I would say that those two positions, I'd say you want to bring in one more inside linebacker. I'm not sure about guard. I think you can re-sign Mike Person and have him compete with Joshua Garnett next year. And then you're right. I mean, wide receiver, I think would be the other outstanding area that just kind of jumps out at you. And you're absolutely right about free agency. I don't really, there isn't a name that just jumps out there. I don't think that you're going to bring in a number one guy through the draft, at least not early on. So that's a question mark. It's something that 49ers are going to have to solve this offseason.
The good news is they do have George Kittle, who is not just the best receiver on their team, but one of the best receivers in the entire league. And I'll tell you what else, Matt, you've done nothing to talk me off my planned off-season radio pursuit of Earl Thomas, because I think that is the number one free agent I would be after if I was the Niners. The Sherman thing has worked out nicely. Let's just rebuild the Legion of Boom right here. I'm sure we'll all have a lot of fun listening to them at press conferences, if nothing else. Matt, thank you, as always, for your time. We very much appreciate it.
Thanks, Matt.
All right, thanks for having me on, guys.
That is the great Matt Barrows, covers the Niners for The Athletic. I am Matt Kolsky. That, you can't see, but I'm pointing to my right, is Michael Urban.
I'm here.
We will be back to break down some of what we just got from Matt Barrows. Also, squeezing a little baseball. The Hall of Fame announcements. The
Harold Baines in the Hall of Fame.
The hot stove sizzling. It sounds more like rain than sizzling, but
it really does.
You get what I'm after. Matt Kolsky and Michael Urban on 95.7 The Game.
Now back to Kolsky and Urban on 95.7 The Game.
I kind of like being not Joe Lowe and Dibs better.
What?
Remember,
you prefer to be called not Joe Lowe and Dibs than to hear your own name?
In a weird way, yes.
That is weird. No, any way you did that, it would be weird.
How you doing, Matt? Happy Christmas Eve to you.
I'm put off now. after that weird comment.
Come on,
all
man.
Confused.
Bounce. Bounce. How are you doing?
Good.
We're about closing in on halfway through. I feel
I don't know
good
if,
about it.
How are you doing? Are you having the best time?
I am having the best time.
Good.
No doubt about that.
If I ever asked you that and you weren't having the best time, I think I'd be worried.
Yeah, actually, Rick was worried yesterday. I worked with Mr.
Tittle. You worried Rick?
Yeah, I wasn't quite there.
I never want to worry Rick.
I wasn't quite there, and I threw him off, quite frankly.
I'm glad you're not doing that to me. Thank you very much.
Well, part of the reason I'm having the best time is because I'm working with you, and
that's
the clock always
sweet.
Flies when we work together, which is always a good sign.
That's very sweet of you to say. Speaking of very sweet, the one and only Ray Ratto joins us about 10 minutes from now. And if he's not sweet, I don't know who is.
Wow.
So that's 10 minutes away. And actually, leading into Ray, and I expect we'll throw some of this at him as well. Don't worry, folks. We'll get back into the Niners. We'll get back into the Warriors. We may even get a little bit into the last game, last football game ever, potentially, at Oakland Coliseum. But, yeah, we got Hall of Famers in baseball. Hall of Famers, we're calling them.
Bad for ball.
Now, I will just say, I am a White Sox fan.
I know.
And ask me how I feel about Harold Baines going into the Hall of Fame.
Matt, how do you feel about Harold Baines going into the Hall of Fame?
It's ridiculous.
I love Harold Baines.
Me too. I enjoyed watching him. He's a consummate pro.
That's it. If there was a Hall of Fame for professionalism and being a good dude,
yeah,
Harold Baines is in. First ballot.
No doubt.
First ballot. Why is Harold Baines in the actual Baseball Hall of Fame? Can you explain that to me? You're the baseball guy. Explain to me why.
Because the Veterans Committee is... He wasn't voted in, so isn't it... How many years is it that you stay on the ballot?
The regular ballot?
Is it seven?
No, I think it's based on your percentage of the vote, right?
For how long you stay? Well, I know if the first time you're on the ballot, if you don't hit a certain number, you're out. You don't stay on the ballot. Yeah.
Either way, he didn't get in on the regular eligibility.
No, that's the whole thing. Like, if you didn't get in, I know it's multiple years, then why is the Veterans Committee coming in and basically telling the Baseball Writers Association of America, which makes up, they do the voting for this, basically saying, you got it wrong. And we're going to put this guy in. And they didn't get it wrong. He doesn't belong in. Again, prince of a human being, very productive, very consistent hitter. But, and I don't even say this because he was a DH for a good chunk of his career. I just say it because he wasn't a Hall of Famer.
To remain on the ballot, the player must receive at least 5% of the votes for any given year. If they fail to receive 5%, they fall off of the ballot until 16 years after retirement. At which point?
Okay, so it's 10 years. 10 years you can be on the ballot as long as you get that percentage.
Right.
So he was on the ballot for 10 years. In 10 years,
do we know what his high? I don't even know what his highest vote percentage was on the actual ballot.
Anybody who had to write that article about him being put in, that better
be
in
there. It's hard to read that article while we're having the conversation, but ultimately, I don't think he was ever especially close. Harold Baines, never higher than ninth in MVP voting. He is a 5-6-time All-Star, and one of those was sort of a token election at age 40, just because who hits 312 at age 40? It's remarkable. And good for him. And you know what? I'm about to read you the statistics from a highly capable career as a baseball player. Over 22 years, he played in 2,830 games. He was a career .289 hitter with a career OPS of .820. For those of you in the Bay Area, .820 as an OPS, just think of it as higher than any Giants had in like a 15-year period. He has, over that stretch of 22 years and 2,830 games, hit 384 home runs. That's good enough for 65th on the all-time list. He has 1,628 RBIs, which is a highly respectable number.
Yeah, for sure. That's the best, I think.
That is a career of a very good 34th all-time in RBIs. A very good, highly effective hitter with tremendous longevity.
So we'll put him in the very good Hall of Fame in Schenectady.
The Hall of Very Good Longevity. He should be in there, for sure.
Yeah.
The Hall of
and
great people, great teammates, all that stuff. But what are we doing if Harold Baines is a Hall of Famer? What are we actually doing? And by the way,
devaluing.
How is Edgar Martinez? Because if this says
thank you,
we put DHs in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
If we're putting DHs in the Hall of Fame, where's Edgar Martinez?
Should have been in already.
Who, look, and again, I'm a White Sox fan. Edgar Martinez, I was afraid of him when he came up. I don't think Harold Baines ever really struck fear in the hearts of opponents. Good hitter.
Mm-hmm.
You got to make good pitches to him.
Obviously, a good guy with runners in scoring position.
Yeah.
Handles the bat
drives
well.
And runs, gives you good at-bats. But Edgar Martinez played less, was an all-star more, finished higher in MVP voting, and was basically the best DH in baseball for most of the 90s. That, to me, to make the Hall of Fame, to me, you should have had to be one of the absolute best players in the game for a few years. And that doesn't apply to Harold Baines. Let's go to Bill in Napa, who wants to weigh in on the Harold Baines issue before we welcome Ray Ratto to the program in just a few minutes. What's up, Bill?
What's up, Bill?
Good morning, guys. Merry Christmas.
Back at you.
So, Harold Baines, you know, the longevity of Harold Baines and his career, I don't think it really warrants Hall of Fame, you know, voting or whatever. But let me ask you this. Since Harold Baines getting in the Hall of Fame, and not a Giants fan, okay? I'm not a Giants fan. But that should warrant Buster Posey getting in because his numbers are diminishing rapidly, sinking like a stone. So would you warrant Buster Posey as a Hall of Famer at this juncture?
Buster Posey, if he gets in the Hall of Fame, will get in as one of the great defensive catchers of all time and a three, if not more, time champion. He's not a Hall of Fame level hitter. He's not even the hitter Harold Baines was, to be perfectly
honest. He's not a Hall of Famer hitter at all. Doesn't have the home run. Has the average, but, he's not a threat whatsoever. But so that should make Giants fans feel good. If Harold Baines is getting in, then you guys, you know, being the face of the franchise and all, Buster Posey should be in, right? According to Giants.
Thanks, Bill. I think that's reasonable. I think that's a reasonable interpretation. Sure. I mean, at this rate, Brandon Belt could get in. But that's one way of looking at it. Is if, and maybe that's what baseball is really doing here, is realizing we're a local sport now. And if we want locals to be invested, we better put their favorite locals in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. It's the Hall of Famous, exciting locals. 510 texter says, was Ozzie Smith the best player at any time? He was the greatest defender of all time for a time. And I think that's what got him into the Hall of Fame. So, yes, I think he was one of the absolute best players. Did he hit at a Hall of Fame level? No. But he was the greatest defender anyone had ever seen for the first, 80 years of the sport of baseball. No one saw a better defender than Ozzie Smith. That's why he's in the Hall of Fame.
And then Omar showed up. No, you don't think he's on the level of Ozzie defensively?
I don't.
Okay.
You ever see him do a flip?
Yeah. Backflips, right?
Omar?
Oh, no. You're talking
about... That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. No.
He's ahead of Omar on backflips alone, is what I'm saying. 925 says, do you feel that the way Harold Baines got into the Hall leaves a door open for Bonds or Clements? That's an interesting question to me.
No, absolutely not.
You don't think the Veterans Committee... Is an avenue for Clemens or Bonds?
No, because one of the big wigs on the Veterans Committee is Joe Morgan, and he sent out...
But he's a jerk, and he won't be there forever. And I think there are probably a lot of former players who feel the way, for instance, Willie McCovey did, or Willie Mays does.
But that's because they're so close to Barry personally.
Well, in those two cases, and maybe you're right, maybe it's telling those are the only two who said that. 510, Baines is the Ozzy Smith of DHs. Get out of here. Just hang up on yourself. It's a good line, but come on. For God's sakes. I love Harold Baines.
Sometimes just the simplicity and old schoolness of get out of here. I just like that.
I love Harold Baines. The thing is, if you try to tell me Harold Baines is the Ozzy Smith of DHs, I say to you,
BS. That's what it is. Pure, simple BS.
Get out of here.
Hang on.
You know, the Veterans Committee is now known as the Eras Committee.
Oh.
Early baseball up to 1949. The Golden Days from 50 to 69. Modern baseball from 70 to 87. That's random. And today's game, 88 and later. Jack Morris. See, here's one where they got it right. Jack Morris went in from the Eras Committee or the Veterans Committee.
Why did they get that right?
I was glad to see. Look, he wasn't a guy who dominated you. He was just, and maybe it's because I was a pitcher and I just appreciate so much all the little things that made Jack Morris so good, and the fact that he was, he had some pretty big spotlight games. And I don't know, I just felt like you have that kind of success in the postseason. I think that should mean a little something. And unfortunately, that means Curt Schilling probably is going to get in.
Oh, he's got
the Veterans Committee.
He should be in for the regular
committee. I agree.
But here's Jack Morris's career stats. 254 and 186. So 250 wins is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
549 games. 3.90 ERA. And almost 2,500 strikeouts. But that's over nearly 4,000 innings.
Right.
So,
and then put the playoff stuff, which a lot of people...
Well, no, I mean,
means something.
Forget it. That's it. It's only the playoff stuff. That's why he got in.
Yeah.
His regular season, he was never great.
Let me throw a hypothetical at you, a local one.
Here's his best season. 14-7 with a 3.05 ERA. I mean, in the 80s, never had an ERA under 3. Not 1 year.
Mm. Yikes.
So Jack Morris was a good pitcher. He was not a Hall of Fame level pitcher, except
postseason ERA.
Postseason ERA for his career,
mm-hmm.
3.8.